From KQED Public Radio, this is the Capitol Notes podcast for Friday, March 26th. Our weekly look at politics and government and fun and dogs and cats and bears.
We're not talking about this week's episode of Lost. I'm in the wrong podcast.
You are.
You need to move
to the Lost studio.
Okay.
That's Anthony York, the editor of Capitol Weekly, and I'm John Myers from KQED. And so, lots of things to tell you about this week, but first of all, a plug, or no, a, well, we'll just say thank you to our friends in Fresno, because Anthony and
Clovis.
I took a road trip.
Clovis, actually.
Well, we were in both, weren't we?
We were in both.
We were in both.
Yeah.
You got a little lost there, speaking of lost. We had a little road trip at the beginning of the week. We should tell everybody who listens to the podcast, right? We went down to an event of the Maddy Institute, which is an institute of public affairs out of Fresno State, and spoke in an event. And then we're on their monthly television show on the one of the local affiliates in Fresno. I don't know what smart things we possibly had to say. Probably nothing.
Same as here. Not many.
Right. Which is real trouble for the viewers of the Maddy Report.
But you get disturbing audio, disturbing visuals to go with your disturbing audio. So it's the worst of both worlds.
Disturbing
really.
Visuals.
Yes.
Yeah. You particularly.
Yes.
You were... anyway,
you'd have to see for yourself.
You're a disturbing fellow. You're right, exactly. Yeah. If you're in the Valley, you're in Fresno, I think it'll be on Saturday afternoon at 5.
On NBC.
On Casey.
Ding, ding, ding.
Good.
Isn't that the NBC?
Yeah.
Or is that ABC?
Something
it's NBC.
Like that. Anyway, thanks to the folks at the Maddy Institute for letting us come down and ramble and pontificate and eat some salmon, which was very nice.
It was good salmon.
It was good salmon.
Yeah.
So,
of course, it was the last two salmon from the river. But, you know, it's good.
I was going to say, don't get into a water issue about ag and fish, and let's not go there.
Okay, moving on.
Moving on. Let's talk about politics first, electoral politics, and then we're going to rotate or flip, trying to use a fish thing, into the budget. So the beginning of the week, we saw something that reporters love. Let's just admit it. We just love reading about campaign finance. Information.
Yes.
We like to know where the money is, what they spent. We pore over those reports when they come in.
Especially when billionaires, as Dan Morane wrote in The Bee this week, when a billionaire opens her wallet wide, it's something to behold.
And even when they're not billionaires, we're curious about where the money comes from.
No, it's true. Yeah. I think, you start getting some answers because, especially in this media environment, it's hard to tell what's real and what's not.
Well, and let's talk about that,
because
you opined about that on the road on Highway 99. You bit my ear about it back and forth from Fresno.
Four cups of coffee in, you know.
But it's a good point. Yeah. But so we got to look at the campaign finance reports from January 1st through mid-March. They were required to file them. They were all percolating out, trickling out on the internet on Monday.
And breaking news flash. Meg Whitman is rich.
She is, and she spent a lot of money. That
yes.
was the top headline out of all the races, the race for governor, Republican Meg Whitman. $27 million spent between January 1st and March 17th.
It was probably all that St. Patrick's Day shopping she was doing.
That's a lot of money, though. It's a lot of money in, 11 weeks of the year? And if you add that to the money
11.
She spent in 2009,
$19 million.
Yeah, she's somewhere above
carry the
40,
one.
Yeah, somewhere above $45 million, $46 million on a campaign this far out from the primary, this far out from the general, already in an amount that eclipses most gubernatorial campaigns in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't know where the upper limit on that one is. Poisoner still had a lot of money. Steve Poisoner, her challenger, still had a lot of money in the bank. Hasn't spent a lot of that money through mid-March.
And hasn't raised a whole lot of new money.
So he still had about $14 million in the bank. Mm-hmm. Jerry Brown, Mr. Frugality, had about $14 million in the bank, had only spent somewhere around...
$1.29.
Yeah, well, I was going to say a little less than $200,000
if you take both his
attorney general account,
which you should,
gubernatorial account,
very
which
good,
you should,
John.
To be fair.
And now the attorney general's account is closed.
Yes.
Right? Yes.
Yeah, because he moved a bunch of money into the gubernatorial
yes.
account. Okay, all of this is beyond what you care about, podcast listener.
Boiling it down, Meg Whitman is rich.
Well, what do we make of that? I mean, we poured through where she spent the money. We poured through the fact that Brown and Poisoner are sitting on money. money is a big issue in this race. There's no way around it.
It's going to be, and I think that we're going to see as time wears on whether or not Meg Whitman's personal wealth is a greater strength or a weakness. And I think that both Steve Poizner and Jerry Brown have tried to use it against her, saying that she's trying to buy the election. And there is a danger of oversaturating the airwaves with campaign ads. Meg Whitman has been very aggressive in her television advertising since mid-January. She's been on the air for more than 2 months now. And if she wins the primary,
after all the radio work she did before
October. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about 8 more months between now and the general election. If she is indeed the nominee, that's a whole lot of Meg Whitman if she's going to be on the air consistently. And the question is there a danger? And I think we can look back again to 1998 with Al Checky, and who went on the air in November of 1997. Is there a danger in oversaturating voters with your message? And does that at some point begin to work against you and begin to breed resentment? How do you draw that line between introducing yourself to voters, getting your message out, and turning voters off just because of the fact that they can't get away from you?
Yeah, well, I mean, and I think what you're getting at, too, is when does it become part of the narrative of the campaign? When does it become something that then the campaign has to talk about the money you've spent? And then also, too, what does it say, what's a reasonable amount of money to run right in a state like California, and what's excessive? And I don't know that, neither of us have a definition that's foolproof on that.
Right. But it's not just the money. I mean, it becomes, money in lieu of experience, money in lieu of qualifications to be governor. That's the danger, right? I mean, and that's what Steve Poizner and Jerry Brown will certainly try as much as they can. That will be the point that they will make, that Whitman is using this money as a mask to hide the fact that she's not qualified to be governor. Whitman will just say, this is the resources needed to counter a career politician like Jerry Brown, who with his union cronies, blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. We can talk about that.
Well, let's do, but quickly, these are all things that are looking forward into the race, but as the race stands right now, they're not things that have hurt her or been an impact. Quite the contrary, it's all worked in her favor so far. We got
right.
Just because I was going to reference the poll,
right.
the Public Policy Institute of California's poll that came out on Wednesday night that showed even a slightly larger lead over Steve Poizner for Meg Whitman than Field had done last week, and someone pointed out to me, the Field poll and the PPIC poll were both out there at the same time.
I got that email too.
Ah, see someone.
Hi, Brian.
Listen, yeah, right. Hi, Brian. Thanks for the email. Podcast listener.
Hey, how about that?
Yeah, Well, anyway, but it's a good point. They were both out there at the same time. I would argue that they found roughly the same thing. I mean, polling is an imperfect science.
Yeah.
But it's nonetheless, PPIC found a 50-point advantage. 50 points. For Meg Whitman over Steve Poizner in the Republican primary. That's a lot. Doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that's a lot. And it found her with a slightly larger lead over Jerry Brown in a theoretical November matchup by about 5 points. Mm-hmm. So I guess my theme out of this was just to say that all of these issues about money and could they start to bleed into the campaign and force the narrative down a certain path and all these things, so far it has worked the way probably they wanted it to work. They
right.
have gotten her out there. They've gotten her name ID out there. People seem to like her on first blush.
Right.
We'll see where it goes.
Now, and it's early days. And look, I think you alluded to this as you were bringing up the money issue. Reporters care about this a heck of a lot more than most people. The question is, as you said, does this become part of the narrative? And does this sort of translate outside of an issue that just reporters care about disproportionately and into something that voters care about one way or another? Look, Arnold Schwarzenegger didn't have the money issue as much because he had celebrity. There was something different there.
He spent his money, but he didn't have to spend his money in some ways.
He got, right. I mean, he got what they call euphemistically, I think, earned a lot of earned media. Some might call it free media, but the campaigns view it as earned. So,
well, let's talk about earned and free media, because now we've referenced your You're opining to me a couple of times.
I'm going to go on a Dennis Miller-esque rant here if you're not careful.
No, but I think you raise a lot of really good points, and I think this is an important thing. You and I are two journalists covering this race, and are both individually guilty probably sometimes, and the press is collectively guilty of something, and that is how much attention you give groups who proclaim to be representing a large point of view, which how do you measure that when you look at campaign finance data sometimes and show they don't have a lot of money out there, they're just trying to make a point and get in the press.
Right.
And case in point this week, the groups that have aligned themselves to be independent expenditure, independent efforts of Jerry Brown, mm-hmm. which the Whitman campaign says they're not independent, but that's another podcast.
Right. It is.
And those groups, the group called Level the Playing Field, which is supposed to represent nurses and some union people and some education people, mm-hmm. The group aligned with the Democratic Governors Association. Anyway, bottom line, we looked at their financial reports. You looked at them driving down the road on your iPhone.
Yes.
And there wasn't a lot of money there yet.
Well, there's about $200,000 in each committee thus far. And look, it brings up a lot of questions. Level the Playing Field is staffed by three very good political consultants, pros who know how to get a lot of the aforementioned earned media, free media.
Get attention from reporters, get their names in the paper or on the air.
They've been very clever. I think clever is sort of the word. You know, I don't want to simply dismiss what they're doing as the stunt work, but a lot of it is meant to be kind of gimmicky, to get some attention and to kind of get under the Whitman campaign's skin and also get the attention of reporters and begin the process of telling the narrative of Meg Whitman, and to counteract her barrage of ads. They're not going to match Whitman dollar for dollar. And Jerry Brown is holding on to his campaign resources for when he needs them. And so this is it's kind of a guerrilla attempt to get into the story. Now, we've heard numbers associated with some of these committees, $20 million apiece. Has that money materialized? No, not yet. Could it?
Will it materialize?
Maybe.
We don't know.
Maybe. But, you know, but it brings up a lot of interesting points. Should we be covering them, giving them the coverage that the $20 million number helped Level the Playing Field specifically get some attention and some money? Doesn't hurt that they were, you know, that the consultants associated with that particular IE are well known to political reporters, and you know, people who we have talked to in the past, who we have relationships with. But it brings up a couple of interesting points. Number one, did we give them too much coverage, you know, based on the resources? But on the other side of that, you know, what are we using as a measuring stick? If we say that we did give them too much attention, are we then making another implicit argument that somehow money equals legitimacy in politics? And what you know, what sort of implication? Like, I've been doing a lot of navel gazing on this one this week.
Soul searching, I was going to call
soul
it.
Soul searching was
gazing.
Strong. Yeah, I think navel gazing was is probably more.
What'd
is more accurate. A little lint and
and a
commercial from Chris Lahane. There was a Megatar in my belly button. It was weird.
That was another web video that was put out this week by one of the groups about Meg Whitman as a little. Not a claymation figure, an avatar figure, her flying around on a private jet, et cetera, et cetera.
It was very Davy and Goliath.
Okay, but let's stick with the media analysis for a moment.
Okay,
because
Davey.
You tell me, you know, you were getting to your point. You've been doing navel gazing, and what have you found? What have you concluded, Anthony? Because then I'll tell you what I've concluded.
To be determined. I mean, I think that, look, the media world is changing rapidly. Not only am I the editor of a weekly newspaper, which is also online at capitalweekly.net, capital with an O.
I forgot your second title this week.
But I am also now the, what did you say, overlord? Was that your word?
It was the viceroy last
the viceroy, week. Right, of the Los Angeles Times California Politics blog, available at latimes.com/California Politics. And so, look, I've got a lot of mouths to feed. You know, I'm on constant deadline there. I think that the changing media world has changed the way that reporters do their jobs, what is considered newsworthy and what's not, and it's changed the way that political professionals, communicators, whose job it is to manipulate the media, and I don't mean that as a pejorative. I mean, I think it's kind of a mutual manipulation relationship.
To affect the media, maybe you can call it.
Affect with an A, mm-hmm. Yes. Their job has changed too, and we're kind of in this transitional period, which, you know, you can argue whether it's good or bad for public discourse, but it's the reality of the world that we're all living in.
And And I think that's a good point to make. There are a couple of things in this media analysis moment of the podcast, and then we'll move on. The first thing I would say is that, you know, one of the things is that the press is not some uniform entity. You know, the mainstream media, the journalists, we're not, you know, we all have different takes. We have news organizations that have different niches out there in the world. There are political reporters who follow the horse race much more than others, you know, et cetera, et cetera. My sense is that when these groups came on the scene, they came on the scene before Brown had actually formally declared he was governor. And so,
candidate for governor.
I'm sorry.
I am governor.
I've just appointed him. Sorry. Brain fade. I know, not a Freudian slip. Republican listeners.
Liberal. Brain NPR, fade. NPR. Steve Poizner hating.
No. It's another podcast. But they came on the scene before Brown had announced his candidacy. And Whitman and Poizner were really the only game in town to talk about the race.
Right.
Every reporter is looking for some kind of alternate voice in their story as
we
talk about the Democratic side of the world. I think when they came on the scene and they announced their intentions and they announced the formation of their effort, they were legitimate news. And the way that the things they said mattered and the things the public needed to know. After that, I think they're not illegitimate, but their value as news shrinks until they actually start, you know, changing the race, having money and effort and momentum or something. And then when Brown actually got in the race, I think they are even less important for a while because now you want to hear from the guy actually running for the office,
sure,
not from interest groups trying to push a particular message. But this is all a sliding scale, and it's all very subjective. And you know, and I do think, I mean, you certainly felt it, and I think a lot of reporters feel it. When you start to see there's no real money yet behind the efforts, you start to wonder how much you feel like you've been played.
Right. Yeah.
About putting them out there.
The, I mean, the other piece of this is get used to it because, yeah, because this is now, 2006 was the first governor's race in which the campaign fundraising limits for a governor were in place. And so because of those limits, a lot of the money that has come in the past to influence campaigns used to go directly to the candidate. Now we're going to see on the statewide level, and now with the Supreme Court decision on campaign finance rules, on the federal level, right, we're going to see what we've already seen in legislative races. The candidates themselves, to some degree, certainly their campaigns, become less and less important, and a lot of the big money moves through the independent expenditure campaigns. Now, the limits on legislative races are much smaller, and so it's not a perfect analogy there, or simile. Did I use the word light? Is that a simile? Comparison. It's not a perfect comparison. But I do think that the money that Jerry Brown has the capacity to raise, if every big Democratic donor maxed out to Jerry Brown, I've heard this number thrown around, $30 to $40 million. If everybody who's given to Democratic candidates over the last 20 years maxed out to Jerry Brown, it would only be $30 to $40 million, and that's not enough to run against a billionaire and may not be enough to run statewide at the top of the ticket in California anymore.
And yet what we don't know at this point is we don't know how much money is enough, because we don't really know at a certain point what's enough to get the message out there and engage the public versus, as we started this whole conversation, how much is too much, how much is just, you know,
yeah,
you know, just being thrown out there, missing the point, which could be, you know, the case if you have unlimited amount of money to spend. And you know, and so the other part, too, that we don't really know where this is going is that every year that we get further into the online world of campaigning, we see campaigns change a lot. We've seen the, you know, even more examples in California statewide than we ever have before of the viral video,
right,
world.
Right.
We've seen it now in the governor's race. We first saw it in the U.S. Senate race with the demon sheep that we can never forget.
Nor would we want to.
Yeah, and so we don't know what part that's going to play either in the voters or in the way the press covers the race. So,
right,
you know, we should mention the Senate race really quickly, too, that the
yes,
PPIC poll showed a tightening, they believe, a tightening from the people they talked to, voters, a tightening of that race where it looked as though Fiorina actually slightly ahead of Tom Campbell now.
Yeah.
Tom Campbell had been the front runner in that race. PPIC shows Fiorina, I think, like a one-point lead, which is clearly within the margin,
yeah,
of error. So we'd have to call that a, you know,
a
pretty even race,
yeah,
with Chuck DeVore still a distant third, at least from what PPIC is seeing.
Would you call that striking distance, though?
I don't know. I mean, he's at single digits there, double digits, you know.
And look, I mean, the numbers themselves, you talk to pollsters at this phase of the game, and I believe that this sentiment was also in this email that you and I both received, which is true. The numbers themselves don't necessarily tell the story. It's the trend. The trend line. And the trend is that Meg Whitman is gaining on Jerry Brown, is perhaps surpassed, and is widening her lead over Steve Poizner. The trend in the U.S. Senate race is that it's tightening, and that Barbara Boxer is now, I think, more vulnerable against any of those three. Certainly Fiorina and Campbell, and perhaps even DeVore, that she's more vulnerable now, appears to be, than she was 2 months ago.
So. And again, this is something that we do wonder, will it drive the narrative of that campaign? We have not seen a Boxer campaign really yet. We haven't seen, you know, the senator engage anyway. She probably would like the primary to play itself out, and that may be fine.
Right.
But of course, you know, you do have to wonder, can you wait that long sometimes if your numbers are kind of weak?
And I do think that this is a race, given the new federal campaign finance laws that are in place now, thanks to the U.S. Supreme Court, this is a place where we're going to see some of these 527s, right? The independent expenditure committees play a big, big role in California come November.
Yeah, and we also have to see how national issues affect things, because we saw in the PPIC poll that 50% of the people they found, that they surveyed, like the health care plan that was passed this week as it stands, even though they may not know everything about it. But as that issue and others' issue play out, you can bet that they're going to bleed into that campaign. The Republican candidates already talking about repeal and saying they stand with Republicans to repeal the campaign. You know, welcome to the national world for California.
And God bless it, because at least it's a real issue. Look, I mean, at least there's a real issue there where Republicans feel one way about it, Democrats feel another way about it. It's not, you know, it's an honest-to-God issue that voters can make up their mind. I mean, personally, as an observer of California politics or of national politics, I'm actually grateful that there's something substantive to draw differences. If this is a referendum on the health care bill in November, so be it. The Democrats have put up their votes. The Republicans have made their position clear. Let's have it out at the ballot box. I mean, that's what politics should be about.
So, speaking of substance, let's talk about the budget.
There's substance, and then there's substance.
So a few little things percolating around, maybe not so small, but a few things percolating around this week as well on the state budget and the attempt to resolve part of the problem. Anthony is just like rubbing his eyes, and like it is though I have told him he had to like, you know, write a 40-page term paper when I just brought this subject up.
Or given me 19 Dramamine.
Or 20 billion.
Yes.
In the quest to solve the budget deficit problem, there was an agreement this week on the complicated, please don't make me explain it, gas tax swap proposal. The Democrats got the governor to sign off on their version, signed it into law in exchange for a few things the governor wanted, not the least of which was a tax credit for home buyers.
Mm-hmm. And green job creators.
And a green job incentive through the tax process as well. We're not describing this very well, because these all, I don't know. My sense is that these are still relatively small potatoes, you know, and this is great.
Are they
this
small
is,
potatoes or low-hanging fruit? Which food analogy
which
should
food
we
analogy?
Use?
I'm going to go small potatoes,
okay,
because I'm tired of low-hanging fruit.
Okay.
It's rotted on the tree.
Okay.
I think these are still relatively small potatoes, because we still have a lot of issues to resolve about this budget. And we're, you know, as we've said before, we're waiting for revenue numbers. We're waiting for everybody to engage on issues like public schools and social services and prisons and taxes. So these are not huge issues, but they do at least represent some sense of compromise this week. At the same time, the governor vetoed a bill by the Democrats to rescind some of the furloughs for some of the state workers. He also lost a court case in that, though he's going to appeal that.
Right.
That's also, no offense to those workers, small potatoes in the context of the budget problem.
And that's raw politics.
Right.
I mean, that's
is that
my,
all you
that's my
say?
Bias.
Yeah, raw politics.
Well, look, the furloughs are going to phase out at the end of June anyway. This is really about sort of scoring chits with various political bases and maybe setting the table to some degree. But the governor hasn't proposed furloughs for his next budget. The furloughs will end come June 30th. So in terms of going forward, there's not a whole lot at stake here.
No, there's, I mean, I agree with you. There's raw politics. There's just a couple of other parts that too, though, that I think are worth mentioning. One is precedent issue.
Yeah.
One, but I do think there needs to be a resolution as to what power the chief executive of the state has or does not have over the general state workforce.
And that will be an issue that the state Supreme Court decides.
Yeah, because a lot of these cases are getting consolidated together. In the case this week, if you weren't following it, you know, one of the crucial issues has been, and this actually was a ruling that was back in New Year's Eve, it's just that the governor had tried to stay the ruling and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But the case is, you know, these are workers whose salaries are not paid out of the general fund, and the general fund is where the deficit exists.
Right.
Their salaries are paid out of special funds.
Right.
And the question is, why are they getting furloughed if that's not the part of the deficit? The governor's argument is we borrow internally from special funds to keep the train running, et cetera, et cetera. So these are precedent issues that I think ought to be resolved. And the other one is, should the governor lose, or the administration or the state, however you define it, lose these cases and have to pay back that money, there's an extra budget problem because there's somewhere in this particular lawsuit around $159, $160 million that you would have to find a way to pay for out of a state that has no money.
And this is in addition to the fact that, never mind the fact that these furloughs have allowed many state workers to build up vacation days because they're taking furloughs instead of vacation days, and those vacation days are paid, full paid days that these workers are accruing. And so there's some debate over how much money the furloughs actually save the state. But I think you hit on the real issue. It's the precedent going forward of what the power of the governor is when it comes to state workers.
And I just quickly, too, I think it also is another, file it away, is another thing under the category of unintended consequences. And the consequences of failing to resolve the fundamental problems you have with the state budget. You know, every time you look for a third way around actual cuts and actual revenues, you end up in these places.
Right.
You know, because that's what the furloughs were. The furloughs were a way around one of the actual real solutions to the budget, you know, by trying to save money in the short term, but it opened up a can of worms in all these other places. We do that when we borrow or transfer or delay payments, you know, so I kind of put it in that category. Again, the consequences of not actually doing the two things that you really know will work, cut tax.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, things like the furloughs have a very profound effect. When you look at in Sacramento on any given Friday, you know, it extends to retail. There are restaurants or cafes or places that cater to public employees that are just shut down on Fridays, on furlough Fridays. And so it's not just the state workers that are being affected. It's all the whatever it is, you know, dry cleaners and coffee shops and gas stations and all the places that, maybe not gas stations, maybe that was a reach there, but there are a lot of other businesses that are impacted by these furloughs.
So that's the end of our topics.
Is that it?
For this week.
Well, it's
not quite it, because Anthony couldn't decide whether Anthony's leaving this to me, and I'm going to throw it in there because, listen, we actually do have people who listen to the podcast.
Okay.
We said there were four. I don't know how many there are now, but they're probably more than four.
At this point, 20 minutes in, you think?
20. Yeah, exactly right, because they love this stuff, right? They can't get
this
enough.
This is the big ending, the grand finale.
But I got a question from a podcast listener, and this podcast listener is going to be tremendously disappointed probably in that we don't have any good answer for this, and we'll opine maybe just for 2 minutes on it and then get the heck out of this. I had a podcast listener ask a question about news this week of a state senator from the north coast of California, Pat Wiggins, a Democrat from Santa Rosa, who dramatically scaled back her workload, was taken off committees, I think asked to be taken off some committees. She has a medical condition that has been undisclosed, but has apparently manifested itself a few times on the job here in the Capitol. There are some, you know, fairly well-documented stories of outbursts that she's had at committee hearings and things that have happened. She's scaled back her workload, and I think the podcast listener said, you know, how could this have gone on this long? Why didn't someone do something to stop it? We, you know, we want to know. And this is a listener from the North Coast.
From her district.
Yeah, from her district. And I think you and I, Anthony, have got the answer of, I'm not sure what can be done with a duly elected representative short of something by the voters or something I mean,
right. I mean, there are recall mechanisms.
Yeah, but you had a description of it about
Well, I mean, there's no look. She's elected to serve a 4-year term now. She's not running for re-election. She's going to be leaving office.
Made that announcement a few months ago,
right? And it's not unprecedented. I mean, look, we elect people. At people live their lives in office. People get old in office. People get ill in office. Now they still have to stand before voters every 2 to 4 years. But we've had lots of examples. We've had Nell Soto, the late Nell Soto, an assemblywoman from who was then an assemblywoman from the San Gabriel Valley, missed I'd say the majority of her time. She was ill, you know, she had an undisclosed illness at the time, and wasn't up here in Sacramento doing the day to day work. You know, going back when people like Bill Craven from Southern California, a Republican from Southern California, Ralph Dills from Los Angeles. I mean, these are people who got old in office and weren't capable of perhaps giving their representatives, the day-to-day service. Now, really, when you elect a representative, you're electing a team. And it's not like these offices shut down. You know, there are staffs who go ahead and even present bills, put forward by these members. And there's constituent work that goes on. But you see
that even when a member has resigned or been something happened, there is some entity that still represents that area.
Right,
we saw
office.
That even when Mike Duvall resigned and, you know, out of Southern California last year, there was a staff that still did things for the district until there was a special election.
Right. Now, you don't get a vote on the floor of the
right.
assembly. You don't get a vote in committee, right. but some of the work and some of the needs of the constituents are still being handled. Could they have recalled Pat Wiggins, perhaps, or could they have excused her from the Senate?
I don't know. And I understand the listener's question, too, about, you know, maybe there's a responsibility question of the lawmaker to step down because they can't serve their constituents. Maybe there are people who wonder where we in the press are on this,
right.
about reporting these stories. Because, I mean, you know, there were instances that happened with the senator in times past, and you know, maybe it's hard to connect the dots as a reporter. And, you know, frankly, we're all following 14 things. And so it's, you know, so I'm not excusing any of that. But I understand the frustration of a constituent wondering, how did we get to this point with an elected representative? And it's a great question.
Yeah.
Which we have no good answer
yeah.
for.
I mean, I will say, look, I'm not saying it's the right thing to do. But there are instances where, there's a comparison there that I won't make. But the Pat Wiggins stuff sort of first came to light in a committee that I was actually sitting in. There was a hearing involving the Air Resources Board that she was in, and there was an outburst in committee that was eventually reported. And you know, I heard about when you're there observing what's going on, it was clear that there was something going that there was an issue. I checked with her staff. I checked with the Senate leader's staff, Don Parada, at the time, and just asked if there was a medical issue going on. And they said yes. And I just sort of deferred. I mean, I didn't know the nature of the issue. I didn't know if it was a lasting problem. I didn't run with the story. Now, the Santa Rosa Press Democrat has been more aggressive, obviously.
And rightly so.
Yeah,
they're the local
it's their
press.
District,
yeah.
you know. But I will say that there are certain kinds of stories that for better or for worse, and maybe this is because of the fact that we're sort of a community paper for the political community up here. We didn't write that story. Is that the right thing to do? I don't know. I mean, you can make a case it was the wrong thing to do. I think a persuasive one, I'm back in the navel gazing media
yeah.
criticism part. Let's bail out of that
media analysis. But I mean, I appreciate the person asking the question. And if for nothing else, it seemed reasonable to say, you know, it's a good point, and we
right.
don't have a good answer, and you know, and there are, I think every journalist thinks there are always stories that you could do better on. You know, there are always things that you might not have covered as much as you would like
right.
to have covered, but it doesn't mean you keep trying to look for the way to tell the stories appropriately.
And at this point, you know, think of it this way: on a purely public policy perspective, if Pat Wiggins resigned tomorrow. They would have to call two additional elections at additional cost to all of the counties that the Senate district serves, and it's a big district. It runs from Napa Valley all the way up to the Oregon border, and you know, you'd have an extra representative. You wouldn't have somebody in place until October, and it would be time to have another election in November. So, you know, not that it justifies the inaction, but
after you said you're bailing out of the story,
No, I was bailing out of the media criticism part, but that it doesn't. You didn't miss out on a whole lot. That's what I'm saying. Hmm. Is that
well? That may or may not have satisfied the listener, but we'll see. And as always, you know, if anybody else has questions, hey,
direct them to John.
Fire them our way. We'll try to answer anything and everything. We did that in Fresno this week.
Can we have a call-in section?
Yeah, caller, you're on the line. That's Anthony York from Capital Weekly, and I'm John Myers from KQED. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.